In this episode, I want to make some personal reflections on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy.
Hi, I'm Rick Ryman, host of Audibly Speaking, a show on the stories behind the stories of our time. By sounding out on these stories, we give voice to them and hear them for the first time. From the news of the day to history and literature, from audiobooks to leaders on the stump, we examine the backstories of our time, audibly speaking.
This is a topic on which I'm doing a lot of research and ultimately planning to write a book, and that should be no surprising to listeners of this podcast. But today I just wanted to reflect on some of the reasons why I think this topic is still very important and ought to be very important for historians. Now, to start off this personal reflection, I might as well just say that I remember the assassination. I was almost 8 years old, and I was in the second grade in Cincinnati, Ohio, when the news came over the intercom. The principal went onto the intercom and told the class and the teachers that the president had been shot. And the teacher we had was an elderly lady who was in the last few years of her work life, and she let out a scream. She was a very well-loved teacher. Her name was Mrs. Houston. So we were all asked by the teacher to bow our heads in prayer and pray that the president would recover, because we knew he was on his way to the hospital. Well, about 30 minutes later, the intercom again came on, and the principal reported that the president had died. And I remember Mrs. Houston screaming again. And I distinctly remember being very disappointed that our prayers did not make a difference in President Kennedy's survival. He still died. So that was a puzzlement to me. And I have no recollection of the rest of that day, but I do remember that the assassination weekend was a trauma for all people, because you could not escape it. It was on television, wall to wall. There weren't even any commercials. It was like the end of the world had come, and nobody knew how to move on. And, of course, the world did not move on until after the following Monday, when JFK was laid to rest, and the country tried to take some steps to move beyond the assassination. But, of course, also during the weekend, there was the killing of Lee Harvey Oswald, the main suspect in the case, which millions of people saw live on television. I did not see it live, but I heard about it from my sister, who did. And, of course, it added to the trauma and the chaos. I remember a couple of weeks later, we got our monthly, weekly reader, and there was a display about JFK. And I remember thinking, because it talked about his service in World War II, I remember thinking that it was such a shame that the world had lost this great leader. And of course, JFK was going to be really sanctified in American culture as a kind of secular saint and someone larger than life, a great hero whose death really shattered a lot of faith and hope and optimism. But of course, Americans also invested that culture in the belief that what JFK stood for could still be realized, and that there would be a united effort by the country to fulfill his dreams and aspirations as people came to see them in the wake of the assassination. So one thing that needs to be explained, because I was part of the baby boom generation, and this was the late baby boom generation into which I was born, because there really are two waves of boomers, one from 1944 to 1954, and the other from 1954 to 1964, and I was born in the second wave. And there are schools of thought on what makes each different phase of the baby boom different, but there are, of course, similarities as well as differences. At any rate, one of the common characteristics of the baby boom was that they grew up and became very cynical about government. They became protesters of the Vietnam War, and they became suspicious of government. They were always remembering JFK fondly, but they were likely to believe in conspiracy theories about the assassination. And some of my friends did believe in conspiracy theories, but I was not one of them. I never, ever believed that there was a conspiracy to assassinate JFK, because the theories were just so wild and improbable. And of course, I haven't changed my mind over the past 60-odd years. As I've become an historian and learned how to weigh the evidence, that has only solidified my certainty that there was no conspiracy in the assassination. But in the 60s and 70s, it was quite popular, especially in the wake of Watergate, to believe the worst about the government, and my best friend certainly did. He ultimately became quite conservative politically as he got older. But for some reason, I never changed. I guess I was a liberal at the time, and I still am today. But on the subject of the JFK assassination, I am a lot like Vincent Bugliosi, who says, "Show me the evidence if you want to convince me that there was a conspiracy in the assassination." There's never been any evidence to support that. Never. There have been many allegations. Most of the 1,000 books that have been published about the assassination insist that there was a conspiracy. And most of those books, or all of those books, I would say, are completely out of whack. They're completely nonsensical. They don't really confront the arguments and the evidence that shows that their theories are incorrect. They simply throw their theory out there, and if they can speculate about something, they consider that as good as a fact. I've never really budged from my position, and I can't imagine that any evidence will arise to cause me to change my mind. But being an historian, we are, by nature, always willing to consider new evidence. I agree with those members of the staff of the Warren Commission who, when they did their work, they were looking for conspiracy, because if they could find conspiracy, they would be national heroes, according to one of them, Bert Griffin. And, you know, you would make your career right then and there if you could be the one to demonstrate a conspiracy. But the staff members of the Warren Commission were so honest that they had no choice but to show the evidence that demonstrated that there was no conspiracy. And it's not as hard as it sounds to prove a negative when we're talking about the assassination of a president. I mean, you have to have positive evidence of a conspiracy in order to believe one. You can't just say, "Well, you haven't proven that there was no conspiracy." Well, we haven't proven that there aren't leprechauns in the sky either. Nobody's proven that. Nobody's expected to prove that. Unless we see leprechauns in the sky, we feel like we are on safe grounds believing there are no such things as leprechauns in the sky or anywhere else. And so that's where we are with conspiracy. Now, of course, there are conspiracies in many settings, and many crimes happen to be conspiracies. There even have been assassinations that have been the result of conspiracy, such as the Lincoln assassination. But those assassinations, those conspiracies, in those cases, which are a minority of the cases of assassination, which are usually committed by one loner, it's fairly easy to track down those conspiracies and to find out who was involved, because people have a way of talking. That's the way people are. And so it was quickly discovered that there was a conspiracy in the Lincoln assassination. But there was never any evidence of a conspiracy in the JFK assassination. What you have when you scrutinize any event as deeply and as intricately as the JFK assassination has been scrutinized, you're going to find discrepancies. You're going to find odd things that are happening, like the placement of Lee Harvey Oswald as an employee at the Texas School Book Depository 1 month before the presidential visit, and the inclusion of Elm Street, which went right by the depository building, on the presidential motorcade route. you're going to have odd situations like this. And it raises the question, I suppose, of whether there was some sort of collusion to make these two events happen at roughly the same time. But when you investigate those odd facts, you find that they are what we call coincidences. And unfortunately for people who don't want to see coincidences, coincidences happen all the time. It's just we don't notice them unless and until they happen in matters of great weight, like the assassination. So getting back to this personal reflection, of course, in the last few decades, I've become aware. In fact, I was aware from the early days of the post-assassination American history, including the 1970s, that conspiracy theorizing was quite an active thing. The House Select Committee investigated the assassination in the 1970s, and they said, well, maybe there was a conspiracy in the Martin Luther King case, maybe there was a conspiracy in the Robert Kennedy case, and we will look at JFK at the same time. And to me, it was quite obvious that the House Select Committee was a response to Watergate and the suspicions of government, which have only gotten worse since then. And so I knew that the House Select Committee was an investigation that was a reflection of its time, even though I was living through that time. I knew that people did not trust the government. But I also knew that that would cause a lot of people to suspect a conspiracy. And that has nothing to do with the facts as they unfolded in 1963. In other words, if there was no conspiracy in the Kennedy case, then the fact that people were suspicious in the 1970s of the government and didn't trust the government wasn't a good reason to assign a conspiracy to what happened in 1963. You couldn't do that. You can't just say, well, now we're extra suspicious, so that's a factor that means it's more likely there was a conspiracy in 1963 than not. I also recall vividly watching the CBS Reports series in 1967 when there were four episodes of 90 minutes each. That's incredible. That's incredible. Four episodes of 90 minutes each on aspects of the JFK assassination, because the CBS News Network, which was the gold standard of investigatory broadcast media, CBS wanted to do its own investigation of the assassination to either disprove the Warren Commission or to back up the Warren Commission, depending upon what evidence it discovered as part of its investigation. And this was just so fascinating. And I remember watching these episodes, and the basic thrust of this series by Walter Cronkite and all of his colleagues was that there are many questions about the assassination. There are many things that are difficult to believe. But when you look at all the evidence as closely as you can, you come up with the opinion that, yes, Lee Harvey Oswald could have fired all the shots that hit JFK. Yes, he could have done it in the 7 or 8 seconds that people were giving him by 1967. And yes, the Zapruder film questions can be answered in such a way that the single gunman theory, a gunman firing from the 6th floor window of the southeast corner of the depository, yes, that is still possible. And Cronkite came to the conclusion that as hard as it is to believe that one man, Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, killed the president in the requisite amount of time, in congruity with what we see on the Zapruder film, and considering all the allegations of other gunmen on the grassy knoll, none of which have been supplied with hard evidence, considering all these factors, it is more difficult to believe that Lee Harvey Oswald did not fire all the shots than that he did. And so in 1967, that was the verdict of CBS reports. But notice they said what they could believe. They didn't actually come out and say, this is what definitely happened. They said, we need access to the Zapruder film to answer the related questions or to make a firm determination that would last as far as all time or as long as possible. So CBS said, we need another investigation. Well, there was another investigation in the 1970s, the House Select Committee investigation. And when it released its report in the first week of 1979, the House Select Committee basically endorsed everything that the Warren Commission said, with one exception. They said there was a shot fired from the grassy knoll indicating the existence of a conspiracy, but that shot missed the president. And so there was a conspiracy, but Lee Harvey Oswald fired all the shots that killed President Kennedy. And the House Select Committee concluded that they have no idea who the conspirators were or whom they represented. And then they closed up shop. Now, to me, what's interesting about this is that there was very little storm and stress or sound or fury about this outcome. You would have expected the country to rise up and say, well, now we need a third investigation to answer the questions with finality. We can't just leave it go at this, that there was a conspiracy, but we don't know who it was involved. That would not have flied in 1964, I can tell you that. But in fact, America was so exhausted by the detritus and the fallout, the cultural fallout of the 1960s and 70s, the war in Vietnam, Watergate, all of the drama of the 60s and 70s, that by 1979, most Americans wanted to close the book on those two decades. They wanted to move on. They wanted to consign to history the assassination and everything that came after the assassination. There was a widespread feeling that America had unraveled since the assassination and because of the assassination. But by 1979, Americans were sick of the turbulence of the 60s and 70s, and they wanted to move on to a quieter decade, one in which they would consign the JFK assassination to a memory hole, and no one was supposed to be the wiser. Well, of course, there have always been people who have picked up the baton and tried to figure out whether the House Select Committee was on the right track or not. And in the 1980s, when most of America moved on and tried to forget the JFK assassination as best they could, these Americans, not really historians, because historians have never really looked at the JFK assassination, and that's a story in and of itself that maybe I'll tell in the next episode, why historians have ignored the assassination. So it wasn't historians, but it was people in the areas of technology, law, and science who tried to investigate this allegation by the House Select Committee that there was a conspiracy on the grassy knoll. Obviously, it had to be coordinated with Oswald, because otherwise you'd have two separate conspiracies that just happened to fire the shots at the same time, which is totally nonsensical. So was there a shot from the grassy knoll? Well, in 1982, the National Science Foundation released a report that said, no, the only piece of evidence that the House Select Committee came up with to show that there was a shot from the grassy knoll, which supposedly missed, was the fact that there was a so-called audio recording in Dealey Plaza on a police motorcycle that indicated that there were four shots fired at the time of the assassination, and that one of the shots came from the grassy knoll. So this entire argument hinged on the authenticity of this audio recording. Supposedly, there was a stuck microphone on this officer's motorcycle that captured the shots of the assassination. And they identified the officer as an Officer McLean, and they tried to get him to verify this, but he wouldn't do so in a way that would satisfy them in the 1970s. And so they just simply dismissed him and did not ask him to weigh in on the matter. But in 1982, the National Science Foundation ruled that the audio recording was made about 90 seconds after the assassination. You cannot hear gunshots on the assassination recording or the recording that was alleged to be taken at the time of the assassination. You cannot hear shots, but some experts in the 70s said you could. And yet by 1982, it was discovered that the stuck microphone was on a motorcycle that was at the Trademark some distance from downtown Dallas, and that the recording was made some 90 seconds after the assassination, when you can hear Sheriff Bill Decker say, "All officers stand in place. All officers stand in place." And we know that Decker issued this order 90 seconds after the assassination. And so once this piece of evidence went up in smoke, the entire theory by the House Select Committee went up in smoke. And so once again, the argument that there was one gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, became the default consensus and has remained so ever since. Yes, you have crazy people writing books saying otherwise. They're a rogues gallery of clowns in terms of their scholarly integrity, of which I don't think they have much, if any. And I don't think it's very sensible or logical to accept the interpretation of a rogues gallery of clowns. But that's what we have in the case of the so-called historiography of the Kennedy assassination. It's not historiography. It's the writings predominantly of self-appointed experts who have wasted their lives trying to prove something that just didn't happen. Something that didn't have to happen, because Lee Harvey Oswald, it turns out, was a sufficient cause for the assassination of JFK. Once you understand all the factors that tragically came together on November 22nd, 1963. Thanks for listening to this podcast episode and this series on the JFK assassination. Next time, we will look at another aspect of the assassination as this historian tries to determine the parameters that we should start from in a reinvestigation of one of the most controversial issues in American history, among which was, why in the world has it been so controversial? Until next time, this is your host, Rick Ryman. Happy listening.
That's it for today's episode of AudiblySpeaking.com. New podcast episodes appear on AudiblySpeaking.com approximately once every 2 weeks. Please subscribe to Audibly Speaking on iTunes or whatever podcast aggregator you enjoy. Until next time, this is Rick Ryman. Happy listening.